Right. If they feel unwanted or unappreciated, then they return themselves.
I don't think it's a kink.
You don't know that.
Oh, maybe it is. Maybe it is. I'm sure that's exactly how Neil Gaiman wrote it.
Bound in leather. Don't put it past Gaiman to be kinky.
Take me to the library.
Welcome, applauders, to this month's podcast. My name is Naomi McQuaid.
I'm Jen McQuaid.
And this is Lydia Malcolm. And you know what movie we're doing because you clicked on the thing.
Yay!
That's until the end, Jen.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
2005.
The year of our Lord.
Let's not get into that debate again about like AD and what that means.
ADE, Jen.
Okay.
Be science. I don't like that. The whole conversation was weird. I was listening to the podcast the other day and I was like, oh man, what a tangent.
Yeah.
Tangent the first 30 seconds already. Okay.
Mirror Mask. Oh, this is a good one.
It's a good pick, Jen.
Well, I chose this because I share a birthday with Jim Henson and I kind of wanted to do something also by Neil Gaiman eventually, whether that's Coraline or Princess Mononoke. So I think we landed at a pretty good place, even though there are some striking similarities maybe in this movie to the last movie we did, because that one was also about dreams and stuff.
The throwbacks to other movies that we've done throughout this film hurts my brain hole a little bit because I was like, oh, that reminds me of that. Oh, we did that in the podcast. Oh, that reminds me. Oh, no, that was like five podcasts. Okay. Oh, like it happened no less than three times, probably more.
We did reference this movie in Cats. I said that their faces look a lot like the Sphinx's in this movie.
But somehow it works in this movie and it doesn't work in Cats.
Yeah, because of like actual artistry in this movie.
Oh, burn.
It's true, though. I was watching the behind the scenes stuff on the DVD because we like own it on Blu-ray. And the director was just like, yeah, I had an artistic vision and there was a way to make this look more like professional and put together. And like, and it's not that it doesn't look professional and put together, but he said there was a way that you could like fixate and make it look more perfect, which is what we were upset about, if I recall correctly, about Cats, how they just like overworked it and made it this smooth, unimpressionable thing, you know? And they didn't do that to this film, and they used that kind of chunkiness to their advantage, and it has staying power for something that has some pretty young in the game computer animation, I would say.
Yeah, like I remember when this movie first came out, 2005, I remember going into it and being like, oh, wow, these graphics look like they're from like the 90s show Reboot. I mean, I love Reboot.
Heck yeah.
But like looking back on it, like 15 years, 16 years later, there's like a little bit of like, yeah, but that makes sense because it's like this dream. It's like this, you know, something in her consciousness, if that's how you want to take it. But even still, like there's still cohesion, like mm-hmm. everything, like from the way that some of the characters look, from the way that, you know, the big boss is at the very end, mm-hmm. you know, it's still cohesive. And so there's still like this distinct flow, this distinct style that kind of meshes well in the world that they created.
And if you've noticed or if you've seen any of the art by the director, Dave McKean, a lot of what they put forth in the artistry and the style is very similar to his other pieces. So, I mean, it really looks CG in some places, but it still reflects. It's like a CG version of David McKean's work.
Mm-hmm. Doesn't it remind you a bit of James and the Giant Peach with like the overall dark tones and these kind of, certainly with the imagery of the masks, like the angles of the face in James and the Giant Peach, like just it makes me feel good in that way. But it's funny because you watch this movie and it doesn't feel as dark once I walk away from it. But then when I rewatch it, I'm like, this is a very visually dark film with a lot of dark tones in the script and everything. But like when I walk away from it and I think about it, I don't think about the darkness.
Right.
In the way that a good artist uses negative space to draw attention to the focus, you kind of forget about the negative space once you walk away from the film.
Hmm.
Yeah.
I feel that way about dreams sometimes, too, like just in general. You don't think about how maybe it doesn't resemble the world. You just think about the story and how you're feeling in the moment and those things.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I guess we're at that part of the show where we tell each other how we came to this film.
Oh, yeah.
Lydia, you were saying that you... Did you see this one in the theater?
I can't remember if I did. I would like to think so, because I would have been like in my mid-20s at that point.
Mm-hmm.
Probably like, you know, going to films on a regular basis.
Mm-hmm.
And so it was one of those... I would go ahead and say yes, though I can't distinctly remember it. But I believe that I would have seen this in the theaters, because I know I never really bought it. So there's always the possibility that I rented it and I couldn't really remember. But I'm going to say, yes, I did see it in the theaters and it was delightful because I like Jim Henson. And this was my first film by Neil Gaiman that I knew was by Neil Gaiman. My first film was Princess Mononoke, but I didn't know that he wrote the screenplay to it. And then when I was like, oh, wow, this Neil Gaiman guy, he really knows his art stuff.
Neil Gaiman keeps showing up for me. Like I will consume a piece of media and then it'll be like, hey, do you know who wrote this? And I'd be like, no, who wrote this? And they'd be like, Gaiman. And I'd be like, oh, really? It's happened like 6 times.
Mm-hmm.
The most recent, well, okay, I didn't know Gaiman did this until today. Sorry. Didn't know. Had no idea. So that's my most recent surprise Gaiman. And surprise Gaiman is the name of our like...
alt podcast.
Yeah.
The name of our alt podcast where we talk about, you know, gay men who just like come out of the corners.
Yeah.
Just like, you know, surprise.
What gay coded character are we going to talk about this week?
Yeah.
I feel like there has to be a podcast out there with two gay gentlemen that has the name Gay Men on Gay Men.
That would be amazing. I would listen to that.
Yeah.
I would guest star on that.
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay, tweet at them. So
tweet at, you know, all the gay men out there.
Yeah, John, do it on my behalf. Okay, but like the last time I had a surprise gay man was I reread Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. And it's not the last gay man book I read, by the way. It's just the last time it surprised me. I was reading the foreword to the Pentology. There's 5 books. 7 books? There's so many books in Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. But the foreword, I was like, man, this guy sounds so familiar. Like, I know, I feel like I know this guy. And I guess if I'd read the cover all the way, I would have known. But I get to the end of it and it's like, signed Neil Gaiman. And I was like, oh. And then I was like, why did he write the intro to Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy? This is relevant later, by the way. I'm not just blowing smoke. Why is it relevant that Neil Gaiman wrote the intro to my Hitchhiker's book? And it turns out he co-wrote a biography on Douglas Adams. And I haven't gotten all the way through it because he co-wrote it. And the parts that aren't written by him hurt my brain. I just don't like reading them. I can tell when he's writing and when he's not. And I don't like it. I mean, like, it's a beautifully written book. But like the second his narration stops, I'm like, oh, it's the other guy or other guys, you know?
For some reason, he reminds me a lot of Alan Rickman, especially the way he talks.
Mm. Yeah, he's a deeply intelligent, non-self-justifying, deeply attractive British man who is kind of, not even kind of, who is alternative. With like the dark hair and like the...
Trench coat.
Yeah. Like, could you imagine, like, if you were like, okay, so just, and if you need to go to a happy place, you're like in a big comfy chair in front of a window and it's drizzly outside and he sits down like a cup of Earl Grey next to you and like, he's like, how's your book? And you're like, except he does it in the accent and you're like, it's wonderful. And he just sits down next to you with his own cup of Earl Grey and he starts reading a book and you're like, this is why holodecks were invented and this is why I've put all my money into it. That's what I want out of a holodeck.
How did you come to this movie?
Okay, so Jen's family does something that my family never did, which is you get the extended family together for birthday parties. So like, so over 20 years, I've been pretty good about like learning how to get into it, but like, it is not normal for me. So when they're like, we're going to go see a movie together for everybody's birthday, I'm like, especially in the beginning, I'm like, oh, okay, all right, dinner and a movie and we'll open presents and have cake and everything. But it's not just the people in my immediate family, you know? It struck me as weird just because my family is so spread out, right? And so they were like, we're going to go see Mirror Mask. And they were like, it's a Jim Henson film. And that's basically all I knew. But it looked artsy and I had a feeling. And sometimes this happens, but I thought it was going to be real pretentious. And I was like, fine. It's what the family's doing. I'm going to go, but I'm going to be judgy, right? And it was in Seattle or somewhere. I remember it was downtown. It could have been Tacoma. But I remember walking out of the theater and being like, oh no, I really loved that film. I have to stop being a jerk about this in my mind. So stupid. Like, I just remember, I was just like, oh, it was good. Somebody was looked at it and thought, oh, this will be good. And it was good. And then I thought, maybe they want me to think it's artsy. So maybe I should hate it a little bit. And I was like, no, but I think I genuinely liked it. I had like this whole debate in my head. And then I landed on liking it. So I like it. When Jen was like, hey, I have to buy like 10 Blu-rays for some reason. I was like, Mirror Mask should be one of those really fancy DVDs you get.
Blu-ray even.
Yeah, because we live in the future. I'm not super interested in owning hard copies of stuff necessarily now, because I'm going to repurchase it. I'll put more money into an industry that I like or a product that I like, and that goes for movies. And so I'll rebuy an album if I change platforms. You know, I'm gonna re-download it and pay the money for it, because I know that a part of it goes back to the artist.
I do that for Nintendo's The Legend of Zelda series. I will rebuy like. Even Skyward Sword, don't tell anybody. I'm super embarrassed about that one because it's probably the worst Zelda game. No, it's not. It's not the worst. It's just there's like...
What is the worst?
Well, I haven't played all of them, so I can't really say. But as far as like the Wii or like the big console games go, it is like my least favorite because of this one boss. Not going to get into it because it could be here all day. But either way, it's like...
What's his name?
Oh, it's like the demise. You do... Okay, so like every time you come... So Skyward Sword is something where... Yeah, now you got me talking it. Anyways, so Sky... And then...
Click your pen and rage.
So Skyward Sword takes place where you have to like go down to... You start up in the sky and then you go down. And so you have to like do this whole back and forth throughout the entire game. And that's fun because you get a fly on a bird and it's like, this is different. I'd love this. This is great. But then
is that the game they're playing on Shantytown?
They finished it, but yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
Okay.
So every time you go back down to the ground, you have to go to this one specific place. And every time you go to this one specific place, there's like this like large thumb of like terror and something that fills me with rage. It's got the silver thing.
I literally
thing
have watched hours
head.
Of this game now, and I don't know what part you're talking about.
Oh my goodness, it's the worst. It's got this like silver thing sticking out of the top of his head.
It's so, not the echidna looking thing.
I think it is.
It's got it's this walky platelet thing, and you have
hit
to stab
the toe.
Its toes.
Yeah, it is.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, I do not like that because it's so like tedious, and it feels like it just breaks up the pacing of the game so much.
Ah.
And it's like this one extra, like you already have a mini boss that like flirts with you and tries to kill you throughout the entire game. And like,
are you talking about the little cat thing that attacks you at night?
No. Talking about the guys in the colored diamonds, like the anti Hal Jenkins. Sorry.
Are you talking about the like otaku Shinigami who lives under the cemetery? Who's just like,
no.
You know what I'm talking about, though?
I think so. No, it's,
I'm going to live peacefully among the humans now.
No, he's great. I love him. Yeah. Anyways. Yeah. But anyway, okay. But like, going back to our original point, because we totally got off subject, it was I will totally rebuy.
Yeah,
Legend of Zelda, Twilight Princess, Wind Waker.
Mm-hmm.
I'm getting a Switch in October when the new one comes out, and I'm going to be getting Breath of the Wild on that, and I already have it on my Wii U. So
that's great. I think that's brilliant.
Yeah.
Hey Jen, how did you come to this movie?
I think we already know since this was.
Sorry, spoilers.
We were at the same place, but this was a limited release film, so everybody in the family kind of asked, since it was going to be my birthday party plus maybe two other people in the family, I asked if the movie, which we generally, especially back then, always saw movies together, everybody asked what the movie should be, and I had recommended that we go to Seattle to this specific theater that had this movie, because I saw some of the previews, and I thought it would be... really great. And we did have, it seems like we had like a Spaghetti Factory or something afterward. But I remember not enjoying this movie. I don't know if it was just the place I was in mentally or what. But when I saw this movie, I was having, maybe it's just the way that the theater's audio was set up. But I couldn't make out what most of the actors were saying.
The audio is hard in this film, I would say.
And I remember distinctly almost falling asleep somewhere in this movie, which if anybody knows me, I'll fall asleep anywhere. So that doesn't really mean it's a bad movie.
Yeah, but like back in the day, you were notorious for falling asleep in the movie theater. But like you were working so hard. I mean, like you're a hard worker in general, but at that time you were like, well, it was just before we got married. So there was like high stress. This came out in October, Lids. Do you remember what happened in December?
Of 2005?
Yeah, we got married.
Oh, wow.
This is 2 months before we got married.
My goodness. It feels like you guys have been been together forever. So like things like your wedding day, which I was there for.
Yeah.
And like the reception at Steel Lake Park.
Yeah.
And you were in a green dress, but not a real green dress.
That's cool.
Yeah. But still, it was like, you know, you guys have always been married to me.
That's so cute.
I feel like I'm Pingo.
Bingo?
Pingo from the Mirror Mask. I'm the mime who's, you know.
I was like,
I talk about smacking kids.
He does. We should get to that because yeah. It's hilarious.
Oh, but we got Sean Facts.
Yes, we certainly do. Thank you very much, Sean, for providing some really great details. So let's start with budget. It was made for $4 million.
It hurts so good.
Mm-hmm.
Like, that is nothing.
It hurts so good to have, like, a fine piece of art, like, and nobody gouged for it.
Mm-hmm. Can either of you remember or guess at what the box office... Now, this would be only theatrical releases.
So this isn't worldwide gross.
It is worldwide gross, but it's worldwide gross of theatrical tickets, not including video releases.
Yeah, because I feel like this movie, at least what I gathered from the commentary, was that they kind of planned on this being a sleeper. They were looking at returns on things like Jim Henson's Labyrinth and The Dark Crystal, and were like, we know this isn't going to be like all the money all at once. This is going to be like...
Right.
It originally wasn't intended for the theaters. It was going to be a direct-to-video.
Ugh, blasphemy.
Yeah. Well, I'm going to guess $5 million because I really want it to make its money back.
I want it to have done enough that the theater was like, yeah, like we're not going to do more, but like, yeah. So I'm going to say it doubled. I'm going to say that it got $8 million.
Box office of $973,613.
And $13.
And $13. It made roughly about 15% of its budget back.
Oh, no. I'm so sorry, guys. It's so good.
It is like it feels like it's kind of like when you find out that Netflix isn't going to renew Dark Crystal: Age of Resistance.
Yes,
I was so upset with that because that's a great show. I still rewatch it, and then I just curl up into a ball and cry because we're not going to see how everything ends in TV form. I want that.
I feel more about that towards like American Gods.
Mm-hmm.
We got so far and then nothing.
Yeah.
So there's a few other details. Let's start with some awards.
Mm.
It received the Black Tulip Award for Best Feature Debut, Dave McKean and Neil Gaiman, at the 2006 Amsterdam Fantastic Film Festival. The Youth Jury Award, special mention, Dave McKean, at the 2005 Locarno International Film Festival. Locarno is L-O-C-A-R-N-O, so it might be Locarno. Locarno sounds better in my head. Audience Award for Best Narrative Feature, Dave McKean, on the 2005 Sarasota Film Festival, and Best Art Direction, Dave McKean, and Best Makeup, Michelle Bell, at the 2005 Sitges, S-I-T-G-E-S, Catalonian International Film Festival. And there aren't a lot of other production-related Sean facts. So I think since most of the rest is kind of scene related, we'll probably keep the rest for later.
So
I do have a couple of quick ones that I found along the internet.
Are these gen facts?
Actually, I only have one big one. It's a big long gen fact for you. Prepare to receive my big long gen fact. According to an interview with Neil Gaiman, the original computers used to do all of the computer graphics were named after the Beatles, John, Paul, Ringo, and George.
Oh.
Later, a fifth computer was required, so they named it Yoko. Soon after the fifth computer was introduced, the network crashed and couldn't be restored properly. The computers basically refused to talk to each other. And then a new server and computers were purchased, and they named them the Ramones, Joey, Johnny, Dee Dee, and Tommy. Gaiman said, "I wish I knew more about the history of the Ramones. The computers performed brilliantly, vibrantly, and died an untimely and early death."
You cannot make this up.
I don't want to be buried
in a pet cemetery. Oh, no.
In a mirror mess cemetery. I don't know.
In a network cemetery.
That's it from me.
Oh, that was great.
Who knows how much of that is Gaiman just
riffing?
Yeah,
but I'll take Gaiman riffing anytime. Yeah.
Shall we dive into the plot?
Okay, so a plotters, just like Naomi's special pre-plot warning. This is another visual one.
Yeah, so we're not going to really be able to explain everything.
How did you not mention the school of fish that fly through the air? How did you not mention the fact that there's calligraphy that you can't read because it's backwards floating through the air? How do you not recognize the art reference X, Y, and Z throughout this entire... Like, guys, this has better dialogue than The Cell, for sure. I feel like it has some artistic references, but it really does lean on... What's his face? Peter. Not Peter. What's his face?
David McKean?
Yeah. It leans heavily on David McKean's artistic vision. And then what he did was he would call people in to do work. Makeup, costumes, CGI, you know, sets, all of these different elements. And then he would empower them because he was new. He decided to rely on the people's strengths. He'd be like, what can you do? And they'd be like, I can do this, which I think they do in Jim Henson Land all the time. They're like, hey, what are you good at? Let's do that hard. And then they go for it. And it's one of the things that makes this such a strong film. So visually stunning. The script, amazing. Can you reference it all? Can you, in a reasonable amount of time, relate it beautifully? No. And that's the podcast you signed up for. So, na-na.
I would like to mention also, I guess this is kind of a factual thing, but David McKean and Neil Gaiman hadn't really done films together. I mean, Gaiman had done like the Mononoke, but this was really their first breakout into films. But they had done some work together, which included The Sandman. And David also did some artwork for Coraline, for the book.
Oh yeah. The illustrations in the book are pretty good. That book is a little darker than the movie, though, for real.
Oh yeah.
Yeah. Did you read Coraline?
No, but I did hear, like, there's a YouTuber by the name of Dominic Noble that I watch, and he goes through, he has a series called Lost in Adaptation, where he goes through film and books and talks about the differences and everything. And I remember him talking about the book being a lot darker.
Yeah. Yeah. The dad, who's a pumpkin in the movie, he's this wet, sand-filled, bloated bag in a dark pit.
Yeah, and isn't like the gateway or the transition from the real world into the world of the other mother? Like, isn't it like pulsing kind
yeah,
of?
Yeah, it's living.
Living, yeah.
Yeah, it's real gross.
It's like a horse getting cut through, and then you have to walk through him, and it's warm, and it's still like breathing.
Hey, reference number one.
Okay, plot. So we're going to walk through the plot.
Let's open on some sock puppet theater.
I called this War of the Toeses.
Is that joke one?
That's joke one.
That's beautiful. I'm gonna cross that out in my notes. Sock puppets. Sock puppet theater. No, it's War of the Toeses.
Oh, wow. These are the only puppets in this Jim Henson film.
You have a white sock come up with a face drawn on it, and it says, I am the ruler of everything good. And then there's a black sock that comes up, and it says, I'm going to go ahead and mark up your beautiful world. And there's like, and then like...
It's holding a marker between its big toe and its second toe.
And then it marks up the white one.
Yeah, it's just scribbling all over it.
Yeah.
And it cuts from the toe puppets to the ticket booth outside of a circus, and there's a woman taking money, and she goes hey to a clown who's walking through the crowd, and she goes, hey, where's Helena? And the guy does some gestures and some whistling, and she's like, hey, you come to the ticket booth. And he's like, all right.
my note was, Pingo is a mime. He doesn't have the tools for ticket sales.
No, he does. He's not. His whole shtick is that he's nonverbal.
Mm-hmm.
And so, like, how? So the guy walks up to the door, he's like, two, and he's like, bro.
Yeah. And the music through this whole opening sequence, because it cuts between these two these two moments mm-hmm. until they kind of conjoin at the very end. But there's also like these beautiful visuals. You get opening credits, but you also have this music that's very flighty, very like, you know,
like saxophone, mm-hmm. but chaos. Not bluesy at all. And when you hear saxophone, oftentimes you kind of put it in that box.
Right.
Either it's part of like a wind ensemble or a brass ensemble. And then it's not as like disjoint. It's not disjointed in like a Kubricky way, but it feels very much like circus saxophone. I mean, literally that's what it is, but like,
Soundtrack was done by Lane Ballamy. He is a professionally known saxophonist and has performed music in a circus.
So he knew what he was getting into.
Right. And so the woman in the ticket booth that hands it over to the mime, it cuts back to the socks again. Because of the fact that it cuts between both of these, when you see the socks, they're up really close, so you can't tell if they're like on hands or something. They look like they're just like socks. You can tell that they're socks,
yeah.
But you don't know if they're on hands or something.
Uh-huh.
And so as the scenes progress, you get further and further out and you see that they're on this girl's feet and she's just laying in her bed, feet up, doing this whole like puppet show to herself.
And she's on her wall, she has all of these pictures, and so it kind of provides this background, like she's made a stage for herself in a way. Joanna, who we learn
is her mom,
comes up and she's like, it's time to get ready, and she's like, I'm drawing right now.
You have no defense against my powerful black magic markers.
Yeah. Yes. I mean, like this conversation she's having between her feet is pretty good. She's like, beneath my black woolly exterior is, what did she say?
A tiny pink foot.
Yeah. So funny.
Those conversations are great.
You need to get ready for this show now, Helena. You've got to get ready.
I don't want
to
get ready. It's a stupid show. I don't want to be here.
This is your father's dream. We all have to make sacrifices.
Do you know how many kids would want to run away to the circus? And she was like, fine, get one of them.
I want a normal life. I don't want to look like an idiot.
You couldn't handle a normal life. This is a conversation going back between Helena and her mom.
Yeah, and they do a pretty good splice screen where the mom is kind of like, she has her own trailer, which is just like, what?
Yeah.
She's outside leaning towards the trailer. The girl's inside upset. And I say girl because she's 15.
Yeah.
This is Helena. She's our protagonist. And her mom says, you don't look like an idiot. No one looks like an idiot. Right? And then all of a sudden she hears or something behind her and she turns around. And there's this clown with like a bird head, like hunched like a gorilla, pushing a tiny trolley. What do they call it? Buggy? What do they call it in Great Britain?
Like it's like a carriage.
Is that what they call it?
Like a baby carriage?
No, there's a fancy word for it.
Oh, okay.
I want to say buggy.
Okay, we'll call it a buggy.
It doesn't matter. It's a stroller. And she's like, yes, to the guy. And like,
yeah.
Pushes him on with his bird beak.
Right. And then the camera changes. So you have them literally on either side of the wall and you can see a clear divide between them. Mm-hmm. So visually we know that there's a clear divide. But the important thing about the scene that you need to know is that Joanne says, she kind of like leans against the edge of the trailer and she says, you're going to be the death of me. And Helena says, I wish I would. In classic teenage form, she is just fed up with her life. She wants her independence.
Mm-hmm.
And she, in the heat of the moment, said something that she will later regret.
Yes. And she has yelled at her mom. She's like, yes, I'm getting ready. And that's when she walks off, you know, and says that offhand, really, remark. But saying things like that can, I mean, really hit you. Yeah. I mean, I don't have any particular that I can pull up right this second, but like we all say crappy things as teenagers.
Yeah.
We say those crappy things to our parents whom we love.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, if you're lucky and you have a decent parent who recognizes that you're going to say crappy things.
Right. Like a decent parent who isn't going to hold it against you recognizes, okay, you're a kid, you're growing, you're going to say things that you don't really mean. You're just saying them in the moment.
That's the thing. They are both guilty in this moment of putting way too much pressure on each other. In this moment, it is incredibly real. It feels very much like a conversation every teenage girl has had with her mother. And what's fortunate for a lot of us is that we haven't had to have that kind of what comes next. But it is a conversation that even I, who like mostly appreciated my parents through the majority of my childhood, I had conversations like this.
Mm-hmm.
And then it's a growing moment when you're like, oh, man, I wouldn't really say that. But we do.
Agreed. So Helena has to get ready for the circus. They go in there. She, you know, puts on her outfit as she does. You see this moment between, so you see her lock eyes with a guy and he's like, what did you say to your mother? And you could tell it was her dad.
Yeah.
Because of how he scolds her.
After the show.
After the show.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then you see the mom and the dad and they have this adorable exchange where they're like, I love you. And one kisses a finger and puts it on his lips.
Yes. Okay. So she does what they call the Spanish.
Oh, yeah. She's like.
They call it the Spanish web. So she does an aerial routine on a single rope where she does some beautiful spinning. And he's like, the beautiful Joanna. He's the announcer.
Mm-hmm.
And then she comes off stage. And when they like pass each other, he's going to go out and do his juggling routine with Helena. And when they pass, they say, I love you to each other. And then she does kiss mm-hmm. her lips and then put it on his masky face. And it is so endearing. It is gorgeously done. It is not too much. It is just right. It shows that Joanna is in it for her husband. She says it's his dream. She's going to commit to it. She is a lifting force for him.
Mm-hmm.
And I, you know, you that's a good marriage. It's probably one of the best marriages I've seen portrayed on screen.
And Helena promptly goes, ugh.
Yeah.
They do their juggling routine and we see Pingo come by with and as Joanna's trying to change into this gorilla outfit. And he's like giving her some advice, but it's all miming. And at one point he like hits his fingers together like this.
He smacks one hand back and forth with the other. If I can visually, verbally tell you what Lydia's doing.
Not doing it very well.
Yeah, but what it looks like is he's saying, oh, so.
You got to smack her around?
Yeah. They're having this back and forth about how her daughter's driving her crazy. And she's like, yeah, like no one can get under my skin like that. And then he mimes smacking her in the face. And he's like, yeah, easy for you to say, she says, as he doesn't say anything at all, which is just brilliant game in, right?
Yeah.
And then she goes, oh, and then she goes down.
Right. She like, she puts her hand to her head mm-hmm. and then she faints. And that's when we cut back to the juggling routine and they're making a joke about like, we should juggle bananas.
Oh, you can't juggle with bananas.
What do you get when you juggle bananas?
Gorillas!
And then there's nothing. Like, they look to the curtain. There's nothing. And then the dad goes, gorillas?
Yeah.
He says it two or three times. Like, he says it after her because she's muffled by the mask she's wearing. But, like, nothing happens. And then all of a sudden, a gorilla pops out with a tutu and a hat on and is like, the crowd goes wild, jumping around. And you see people rushing backstage. They do this back and forth. It's really great.
Right. After the routine is done, everybody who's on stage, you know, bows and then they go back there.
And then the dad starts chastising the mom. He's like, hey, you were a little slow. We almost lost the momentum with the audience. And dude pulls the head off and he's like, I'm not Joanna. He's like the muscle guy. And he like nods in the direction. And dude looks and sees his wife sprawled and then running. Mm-hmm. You see him. Oh, it's heartbreaking.
And then at the very end of the scene, you have him running. And then you see a cut to an ambulance coming. And then you see the last cut is from behind the ambulance going away from the circus. Mm-hmm. So she's being taken to the hospital. And that's what the visual cues are telling
us. Do we have like a picture of Helena? Like, she has an anguished face. I have a feel like we're going to get a bunch of that, but you can tell like instant regret.
Yeah, like instant regret as to what she said. She was like, uh-oh, now things are serious.
Now there's a segue. We cut to a picture on a wall of a face of something or other. I can't remember the image very well, but it says 10 days later.
Right. And I think it's not the front of the card because...
No, this is hung up on the wall and she's drawing on her bed.
Mm-hmm.
And we cut from her bedroom where she's drawing a get well soon card. And we cut to the living room where Aunt Nan is sitting on the phone and we kind of hear her having a conversation and it sounds kind of medically related. And then, you know, it cuts back and forth once or twice. And then Helena grabs money from her piggy bank and goes out to the living room. And then Nan like looks at her phone. She's like, I gotta go. Clicks really fast.
Right.
And then I don't get why she does that. Like, we don't get a clear motivation as to why she would not let her speak to her father.
Well, I don't know if it was her father. I think it might have just been like just someone else and she was talking about everything that was going on.
No, she said it was her dad.
Oh, okay.
She goes, was that my dad? And she goes, oh, yes, on the phone. Yes, that mm-hmm. was your father. She goes, I asked you to let me talk to him when he called.
Oh.
And she was like, oh, sit down and watch this educational show with me. And she's like, I'm going to go visit mom today. And I need to talk to dad. The hospital's asking. And she's like, oh, wasn't that educational? Just trying really hard not to. When things are tragic, like, you got to sit in your grief. You have to experience it. And there's no perfect way of doing that, but certainly it's important.
And it's better than just ignoring it.
You're not helping a kid by ignoring it.
Right.
I mean, by all means, be simple, depending on the level of tragedy. Like,
right.
I was listening to an NPR show that was, I can't tell you specifically what it was, but this guy was talking about how his son had died. And it was terribly sad. The kid was probably 2 and he got sick. So what the guy said was what he had to do, and what I've taken to doing myself, actually, is you have to say what happened honestly and simply to yourself so that you remember that it's true. His son got sick. He went to the hospital. He didn't get better. He died. And then he would personalize it. He would say, you know, my son got sick. He went to the hospital. He didn't get better. And my son has died. And you have to say it. I just can't imagine not being that simple with a kid. Because you can trust a kid to handle really difficult situations, but you have to give them that. You can't shield them from it. That's one of the major things that messes you up. So it should have been, your mom got sick. She's in the hospital. These are the things we're going to do. We're going to try to do surgery. There are no guarantees. Mm-hmm. That's hard. That, you know, it's not easy to process. But like, if you aren't given something to process, you're just a machine that's whirring and burning itself out, you know?
Right.
So anyways, welcome to therapy, applauders.
Helena is just kind of like, she eventually just kind of ignores her Aunt Nan. Mm-hmm. And just is like, I'm going to the hospital. And we see her getting off the bus and she gets into the hospital. And like the first thing that she does is she says hi to the receptionist and the receptionist gives her a hairbrush.
Yeah, she's like, fix yourself up. Yeah. She doesn't say it, but Helen knows she has to fix herself up before she goes in to see her mom. Right. She gets confronted by a nurse who's like, I need to talk to your father about blah, 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 blah.
Yeah.
But not giving her any information, but says that she needs to talk to the dad. And she's like, well, he's not here today. And
she's like, well, you know, the doctor left him a message. She's like, yeah, he's talking to the bank. My note here was hospital staff knows this family, cares about this family, loves seeing that. Like, it feels just like you can tell that, like, whatever this family has gone through, maybe they've, you know, had to be here. Like, later on, we find out that this isn't the first time that this has happened before. And
oh,
so,
really?
Yeah.
I didn't catch that.
Yeah. It was like, it's going to be coming up in a few scenes. Mm. That's okay. I didn't catch the fact that, you know, she was on the phone with the dad, Aunt Nan. So.
That's fine. You know what I appreciate about the scene where she goes in with her mother? Mm-hmm. The mom isn't unconscious.
Yeah.
Like, I was a little, watching it, I was a little afraid that we'd have the trope where the person is instantly unconscious. It's really hard to have any kind of progression.
But she's had time to talk with her mom, mm-hmm. and that is an important character beat in the next couple of scenes. So
she has a brief back and forth with her mom and right. Gives her the card, notices that her roommate is eating the fruit she brought yesterday. And she says, I'm not to eat today, to her daughter. And she kind of like sideways squints. And if you have hung out with people at the hospital, you know that if you're NPO, you have a likelihood of having surgery.
Yeah.
So like it's mm-hmm. just like you get nothing passing orally.
Right.
And that's not it. I know it's Latin or something, but NPO, nothing passing orally is what it seems, always sticks. That's how I remember.
Right.
I was like, oh, no. Yeah. Oh, no. Oh, no. It's bad.
And this is why I love this movie. They don't just flat out say that, you know, oh, yeah, I'm going to have surgery. It's more like these little hints. And they show you that the adults do not want Helena to worry. But she's smart and she is still getting worried because she knows nobody's telling her anything.
Mm-hmm.
And that's making her worry even more.
Yeah. I mean, wouldn't you? It's like hearing, that's what anxiety does on the verge of depression. It's boss battle music and you're waiting for it.
Mm-hmm.
And you don't know.
Yeah.
No one's told you. No one's like, around this corner, there's a guy.
Right. And after this scene, we then cut to a meeting between the circus performers and Helena's dad.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Her mom does give her the girl with the curl poem.
Mm-hmm.
And if you don't know.
I don't know.
Oh, it goes, and they say it more British than this, but the way I learned it was, there once was a girl with a pretty little curl right in the middle of her forehead. And when she was good, she was very, very good. And when she was bad, she was awful. And that's how she's describing her daughter to her daughter, which I think is fantastic. But like, so we have this friend who used to say, you remember, I'm so sorry we keep referencing you, Sharita, but it's so funny. She would quote, I forget where she got it from, but she would go, there once was a girl, and she often had her hair in curls, right?
Yeah.
So she'd be like, there once was a girl with a pretty little curl right in the middle of her forehead. And when she was good, she was very, very good. And when she was bad, she was better. I love it. It reminds me of Mae West.
Yeah.
You know, when given the choices of two evils, I always try the one I haven't tried before. Choose the one I haven't tried before.
Yeah.
All right. Okay. So there's this coming of minds about what to do with the circus next. And they haven't worked in nearly 2 weeks. And what are they going to do for money? They were already like scraping by. And you can't be off work that long with that many people and keep the troupe together. And there's yelling. Mm-hmm. And like, I need to talk to yous. And it's very uncomfortable.
Right. And Helena comes in and she's like, Dad, I need to talk to you. And he's just like, okay. So he's taking his a moment, and she pretty much talks to her dad like, you needed to talk to the doctor. You needed to be there today. And
so he goes off to make the phone call. And then what's the guy's name? The Whistler.
Oh, Pingo.
Pingo.
Yeah.
Worst name. Anyways, yeah. Pingo comes over. He starts to do the whistly thing, but then he speaks, which always shocks me because I forget that he can do that.
Yeah.
It's like the only time. He's like, hey. Hey, at least you're getting out of the circus you always wanted to. And she's like, not like this, not like that. But then like the girl next to him who's got a shorn head,
yeah,
and she seems pretty much over it.
Before that shorn-headed lady says this tidbit of wisdom, Helena says, not like this. This was my dad's dream. And then the sheared head lady says,
dreams only get you so far. After that, you need money. Except I think she has a Russian accent. So she goes, dreams only get you so far. After that, you need money.
Beautiful.
Yeah. So she goes and does some art therapy upstairs on the roof, and I call this angst graffiti.
Right. This was the moment where I was like, this is a scene between Helena and her dad. Mm-hmm. She's drawing as a way of like coping with everything that's happening. Mm-hmm. And she's not really wanting to talk. I mean, she knows that she needs to talk to her dad, mm-hmm. but she's just kind of not facing him. And so she's being very blunt with, you know, like, this is where we learn that her mom, that this is not the first time it's happened. Her mom is, I think, already gone through surgery once, and it was supposed to take care of everything, but it didn't, and now it's come back. So maybe it's like a brain tumor. I don't think they get too specific.
They really don't.
Yeah, which is fine. I mean, you don't need some kind of disease like Wayland's and fracture to go ahead and make a poignant scene, and this is the proof.
Did you say infarction or infraction?
I think I said it doesn't matter. It didn't matter.
It didn't matter then. It doesn't matter now.
Yeah. But this is the moment. So Helena is played by Stephanie Leonidas, who in this moment is talking with her dad, played by Rob Brydon. And the exchange between the two of them, like, this is such a well-acted scene because you can tell, like, it's not just well-written, but it's also well-acted. Mm-hmm. Like, the dialogue gives the actor something that they can work off of because you can see how frantic Helen is when she's coloring. Mm-hmm. You can see, like, how she's not wanting to look at her dad, even though this is a serious moment. And she has this moment when she's like, will I be able to see my mom tomorrow? And he's just like, we'll see. And that's what it was like, the surgery is going to be coming like that day.
Yeah.
And so like she pretty much breaks down.
She's on the verge of tears and she's like, I haven't even got a chance to say that I'm sorry. Really sorry. Not in a way that she believes.
Yeah. And so she just like melts down at this point, mm-hmm. which I mean, like she's had 10 days to talk to her mom. But I mean, if you really feel bad about saying something, you know, especially if you have a lot going on, it can be really difficult to admit something that you've done wrong that hurts another person. And now you have to put on top of that the idea that you may never see that person again. So like, it's a really well acted scene. Her dad comes and like just is just like, no, this isn't your fault. This isn't your fault. It's just kind of like, this is life. This is how it sometimes happens. Mm-hmm. And he comforts her and then he takes off his very Neil Gaiman jacket.
Yeah.
And he covers
he's like, you want to wear his dad's jacket? And she's like,
He's like, you look like a real artist now.
She's got her box of charcoal.
Yeah, that she brings in.
Yeah. It's so, okay, so now we have the dream sequence.
One last thing that I wanted to note is when they go through the door, you very clearly see it's a door with a window, but it's drawn on it. That is important for later.
True. Let's go to that dream sequence I mentioned just a moment ago.
Yes.
So the mom is being wheeled through a red lit dream nightmare hospital. It's an interesting dream sequence because it's chaotic and it's scary. And I think she dies in the dream. Like she rolls to the side and her eyes are black.
Yeah. You hear a flatline.
Yeah. Which is totally not cool. Because so then we have Helena waking up in her bed.
Right.
You see her sit up and put on her bunny slippers, which mint, which is probably why I've bought like 2 or 3 pairs of bunny slippers over the years. So sorry.
I used to have a pair of lion slippers. They were the fluffiest thing and I love them so much and I have no idea where I can find another pair.
Amazon, probably.
Maybe.
She thinks she hears something. So she goes to find her dad And then she grabs a flashlight and wanders out of the apartment and follows. I assume she's following noises. It's this very tall, high-rise, derelict apartment. They're obviously broke. And she, like, she ends up going outside into, like, an alleyway.
Right. I think she, I think we hear, like, violin music.
So she's probably following the violin music. And it's interesting because we've had this scary dream sequence. She's woken up in her apartment, and from the exiting of the apartment building into the alleyway, we realize that we are still in a dreamlike place because she comes across a guy in a mask with a violin who's playing beautifully and two jugglers who are like trying to get their routine together. She recognizes the violinist and she's like, hey, hey, is it Pingu?
No, it's Eric. She's like, Eric, is that you?
And dude doesn't respond. He just continues to play. And guy who's juggling is like, hey, don't distract the musician. And she's like, Eric, what are you doing out here?
So weird.
Yeah. So of the two jugglers, one is giving all of the orders. They're in shadow and they've got these glowing orbs and he's bossy. He's Irish. He's talented. My type.
Agreed.
He introduces himself, I believe, as Valentine. In the finale of his little performance. And then we perceive this black mold, decaying, fast-moving junk, like, envelop the violinist. And she's like, what the? And she goes to touch it. Valentine's like, no, don't do that. Don't do that.
Right.
And so she, like, backs away, and they're trying to escape. They get to a door. The other juggler, I rarely notice this, but I did today. He starts chucking his orbs at the decay.
Yeah.
What are we going to call it?
I called it tar.
It's called the darkness or something like that. Yeah.
The nothing, now in gelatin form.
Yeah, okay. But he's chucking these orbs that explode like fireworks, which is really kind of cool looking. But he also gets absorbed.
Right.
And then they escape through a door.
Right. And Valentine laments the fact that he just lost. Or no, this isn't the moment. Well,
he does mention that it's his friend, his soulmate.
Yeah.
His terribly talented whatever.
Yeah, partner.
Yeah.
And so they are in, now they're in a room.
A junk room. They call it a junk room. Oh, yeah. She calls it a junk room.
Right. But they there are like books on a shelf. There's like, isn't this where they have like a human, it's pretty much a sphinx.
Yeah, a sphinx comes in. It's a cat, human face, rainbow winged cat thing. Do they all have the same face? Is it all the same guy? Is it all Robert Llewellyn?
I believe so. Let me double check.
I know that one is, that older one, the bigger one is.
The griffin.
Okay, so the sphinxes are different than the griffin?
Yeah, the sphinxes are like the little house cat kind of ones, and then the griffin's much larger.
Oh, yeah, yeah. The griffin is Robert Llewellyn, and the sphinx is Simon Harvey. But the griffin kind of comes after him and is like, you know, this, and then, before the griffin comes in, Valentine does chastise her for wearing bunny slippers.
What kind of sick mind walks around and treads around on fuzzy little rabbit creatures?
Yeah. And so he says, throw pages at it, rip out pages
like,
in the book.
Throw a book at it. And she's like, she starts reading titles and he's like, he's not going to read it. And you're like, what? I mean, you should already be like, what? Because there's a sphinx in the room. But she throws the book and then it like starts tearing it and chewing its pages. And then he's like, grab two big books.
Right. He, as it's being distracted, he opens up a door and you can see the nothing, the Neil Gaiman nothingness coming in and like creeping closer. So they have to make a quick escape. And so he opens up a door and it leads to nowhere.
Well, there's a drop outside.
Right.
And we do see the eyeball spider
right
at this point.
There is an eyeball spider kind of creeping and watching them and everything.
Yeah. They never seem to notice it.
Right. Not at this point anyways. Yeah. No, I would think, no, they never really
acknowledge the eyeball spider, but it's a cool little plot device.
Yeah. So, I mean, since we're talking about it, this is my second joke.
No!
Spider eyes are watching you.
Spider eyes.
So, but...
I don't know any more of that song.
I know, neither do I. So, but Valentine says, grab a couple of books, like really big books. And so she grabs a couple off the shelf and
throw it on the ground. I can't do an Irish accent.
Right. She's like, you have to belittle it. Oh, no. He does say to throw it on the ground. So she throws
it. No, not like that.
Yeah.
Because she just kind of,
Yeah. And he's just like, you have to belittle it and make it feel worthless. And then he says, you're a horrible book. And then he throws it down.
I mean, like, degradation kink is a whole thing. And if books got it, no, I'm not mad as long as it's a...
Well, you find out later that the reason why he does this is because it floats them back to the library.
Right. If they feel unwanted or unappreciated, then they return themselves.
I don't think it's a kink.
You don't know that.
Oh, maybe it is. Maybe it is. I'm sure that's exactly how Neil Gaiman wrote it.
Bound in leather. Don't put it past Gaiman to be kinky.
Take me to the library.
No.
So they make their escape. But what does Helena say? Poorly paced book with a sopping ending that I didn't believe for even one second. Then she throws it on the ground. And what it does is it like flips open. So The pages are underneath and you're standing on the binding of it.
Yeah. The same thing happens in American McGee's Alice in Wonderland.
It reminds me of The Page Master with Macaulay Culkin.
This is the second time I think we've referenced The Page Master.
Oh, really?
I'm not a drawing. I'm an illustration.
What was the first time? I think it was in the Neverending Story review. We talked about that.
It makes perfect sense. Books and whatnot.
The books are floating over to the library, but we see them. The scene cuts. Because I don't think it cuts to the spider like crawling out and going somewhere.
No, it does. We do. The queen found her.
Okay.
It happens in this scene. We see the spooky dark queen. She has the eyeball. She holds it up to her face and she's watching now.
Thank you for joining us for part one of our review of 2005's Mirror Mask, A Plotter. We've given you a lot to reflect on, but we still have two more parts of September's episode, so we hope you'll juggle a few things around to stay with us. We're also celebrating podcast book clubs this month, and think we may have paged through a few great finds for you to check out. Spice World is a weekly fiction, science fiction, and arts podcast that explores Frank Herbert's Dune. And The Island Library Podcast discusses books they've read and answer the ice-breaking question, would you take this to a desert island with you? You'll find links to these shows on this release's description. Hey, this is your audio engineer and the person Pingo keeps pointing at, Jen. We're celebrating 4,500 downloads this month and wanted to give you a special thank you for catching up with us each month for our epic Peculiar Film Walkthrough podcast. If you haven't already, how about sharing that love even further? Let your friends know we're easily found at shockedandapplaud.com, on Twitter and Instagram at shockedapplaud, and Facebook at shockedandapplaud. We've still got quite the journey ahead of us, and we'll see you in 1 week for part two. From Shocked and Applaud, thank you for patroning the peculiar.